You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole publishers of Steiner's work into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a collected work by Rudolf Steiner, number 181, consisting of three lecture cycles. Main title is Dying Earth and Living Cosmos. We are in the second of the cycles, The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy, and this is lecture 12, which I believe is lecture 6 in the cycle of 7, that is The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy. All these are translated by Matthew Barton. Lecture 12 was given in Berlin on the 16th of April, 1918. In my public lecture yesterday on the human and animal world, I referred, among other things, to an idea we can form about human soul life, which is not simply hypothetical, but does really correspond to reality. In speaking of the world of animals, I pointed to the beginning and end of life as two moments when physical life first enters and then departs, the moments of conception and death. I said that we could see this as a ladder, with conception at the beginning of it and death at the end, and that these two experiences really pass through the whole of human soul life, that at each and every moment this soul life comprises in a whole what is experienced in animal life when the genus soul, the animal group soul, which never fully arrives on the physical plane, enters into a reciprocal relationship with the physical entity at conception. And similarly, something like a hint of I-consciousness appears fleetingly in the animal at death. Someone able to observe the death of an animal, as I said yesterday, can form an idea of how something that runs throughout our human life, our I-consciousness, is only present for the animal at this moment when life departs. But the important thing here is this, that these two moments, really only two fleeting moments in animal life, are combined in us in one as in a synthesis and run throughout our human life. Thus the human head, the distinctive nature of its organization, as I described yesterday, can, in a quiet echo of this, develop a continual conceiving and dying. And this gives rise, in fact, to the justified idea of the soul's immortality. This life of the human soul, therefore, continually emerges from the interwoven union of conception and death. I then added this: whenever we have a thought, this is born from the will. And whenever we will, something thought dies into this will. Schopenhauer represented this in a very one-sided way by regarding the will alone as real. He did not recognize that, in quotes, will is only one aspect of the matter, in a sense only the dying thought, whereas the thought is will coming to birth. If we share Schopenhauer's view of things, it is like thinking that human life only consists of the time from age 35 to death. But before 35, of course, we must have been living in order to reach that age, must have been born and have developed. Schopenhauer acknowledges only the will, regarding the idea as mere appearance. Yet that is only another form of manifestation, the idea of will that seeks to be born or realized, whereas thought is the dying will. In our soul life, thought and will are continually interwoven. And we can see this at the same time as birth, originating in conception, which is perception, and dying. To form this picture, and even to substantiate it anatomically and physiologically, we need nothing more than our modern science and the will, the good will, to really observe soul phenomena. We can interpret modern findings about the human brain in a different way from mainstream science. If we study the physiology and biology of the human brain with an open mind, really examine it carefully, we discover that what I just said has a sound scientific basis. There are many fantastical notions dreamed up nowadays in universities, along with psychological and physiological experiments, undertaken because anatomists do not actually think, but instead just sit down at their apparatus to maltreat the psyches of their students, firstly, and then attempt to study these psyches. If people refused to allow this, it might be possible instead to really observe the human soul, to develop a living concept of the soul and of the ongoing process of birth and dying within it, of this metamorphosis, which is only an enhancement and refinement of Goethean metamorphosis. But after 100 years, modern science has still not managed to understand Goethean metamorphosis, let alone advance an idea of such benefit to humanity. What I tried to outline yesterday is in fact nothing other than the idea of Goethean metamorphosis taken further and elaborated. Such things can be discovered without the need for clairvoyant perception. They draw only on a truly scientific approach and the capacity to study the human psyche. If a number of students were introduced to such things in a way they could understand, rather than having all the current idiocies foisted on them, we would move a good deal closer to spiritual science as something that can really inform modern culture. You see, such ideas, which can be scientifically ascertained today, require nothing but goodwill to become fully fruitful for human soul life. Goodwill to observe carefully and accurately and to have corresponding thoughts. And such ideas can create a bridge from outer science based on the sensory world to a spiritual science. The latter makes no headway, not because it is incomprehensible to people who have no capacity for clairvoyant vision, but because the modern scientific outlook is so fiercely opinionated that it cannot countenance something new like this emerging. In my view, no harm is done if we describe things as they really are occasionally. Still more important than an idea like this spreading as an idea is its effect upon the life of the human psyche. It matters much less what kinds of thought we have than what powers we must apply to grasp a particular idea or thought. Our state of soul will inevitably be quite different if we are thinking a completely dead idea of modern science or a living spiritual scientific one. The latter involves our whole being. It inwardly enlivens us and integrates us with the cosmos. Such thoughts as arise from modern science, by contrast, especially when it exceeds its intrinsic narrow remit, sunder our connection with the universe. We have to realize this, and spiritual science really must express it on humanity. You see, precisely where things start to be of direct importance for life itself, for instance, in education, in children's upbringing, and everything connected with it, it is of boundless importance for the psyche to dwell in living ideas and concepts. Someone who can regard things in a living way will be able to draw on a science of the spirit to undertake the tasks and actions of key importance for our whole modern culture. The full significance of this really needs to be understood. If it were, people would recognize how much we need to review with an open mind the almost wholly distorted thinking that underlies practical measures today. People do not easily discern the symptoms of this distorted thinking. Yesterday I pointed out that amongst ourselves too, we must strenuously avoid lax or lazy thinking of any kind. Consider what will happen if we allow lazy thinking to prevail. In all my recent lectures, I have been singing the praises of a book by Oscar Hertwig, called titled The Development of Organismus, calling it the best scientific work of recent times. My lack of reserve in heralding this book is because someone at the forefront of the scientific methods of his time has undertaken to unpick Darwinism and push it back into its proper confines. I agreed wholeheartedly with him until the last few pages. But now his next book has been published, entitled In the Defense of Ethical, Social, and Political Darwinism. And really, it is hard to find words sharp enough to object to the impotence, narrow-mindedness, triviality, and nonsensical nature of this book. And this is because this research scientist has now departed from his proper narrow field and started talking unalloyed garbage. This good fellow, for instance, states that all scientific methodology should follow the model of astronomy. This is not, of course, an original idea. Dubois-Raymond said it back in 1872, when speaking of the atomic structure of the world. But how on earth can we observe the realities around us if we do so based on astronomical theory, which is as far removed as possible from us as human beings? In terms of logic, this is as pointless as trying to understand a family living in dire poverty in the country, not by observing this family itself, father, mother, son, and daughter, but instead of by contemplating life in a wealthy manor house and drawing on these observations to formulate laws about the poor family. Such things are simply overlooked nowadays. People lift their gaze away from reality. But we should take due regard of it. We at least should avoid either relying on authority or lazy thinking. We can be clear that a favorable judgment about someone, in a particular instance, does not mean that we subsequently rely on anything else he has to say. A really open mind and lack of prejudice means that we appraise Oscar Hertwig's work as outstanding in one instance, but as utterly worthless in another. If we fail to practice this discernment, we overlook life's realities, on the one hand, and gain no insight into the world of spirit, on the other. I'd like to give a small example here. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, at least to the degree of really gaining benefit from it in daily life. A little while ago, an article by Fritz Mautner appeared in the Berliner Tageblatt, refuting a book which dealt, among other things, with Goethe's horoscope. This review by Mautner was quite amazingly trivial. In a great many self-satisfied column inches, he tried to show how out of touch the author was to write about Goethe's horoscope, and to do so even in a series as popular as the one entitled Nature and Culture. This article struck me as taking triviality to new depths. The author of this book, in the Nature and Culture series, is in fact a fairly average modern academic, and it was hard to see why Mautner was getting so worked up about it. What was he objecting to, especially since the author in question was poking fun at all the people who give serious credence to such things? So Mautner was attacking the man merely for raising the subject. The same author who wrote this little book sent a reply to Mautner's critique, published in the same paper, saying it had never occurred to him to promote astrology. In fact, his academic approach accorded fully with Fritz Mautner's views. The two were in agreement. And yet Mautner still saw fit to launch his tirade about the grave social dangers of publishing such a book in that series. For its part, the Berliner Tageblatt noted that it agreed with Mautner's view and did not consider he had misunderstood or misrepresented things. This is just one particularly striking example of the degree of spiritual debility underlying all such phenomena. If we examine whether such journalism, such inferior cultural activity, in any way invigorates life, we arrive at some characteristics of modern culture which it is necessary to be aware of, if we are to understand what benefit spiritual science can have today. Above all, we need to know that mendacity and lies are real powers. One can scarcely imagine anything worse than what I have described here. One person writes a book about astrology, another attacks him for it, and the first defends himself by saying he was only poking fun at the idea. If he had prefaced his book by stating that his account of Goethe's horoscope was a joke, then Mauthner would have been satisfied. These things are serious and connected with the most serious modern concerns, above all with the fact that in our age, spiritual science will have a hard task in making headway, in achieving what it needs to. It requires really strong and courageous thinking. And alongside all its content, we need to recognize that strong, courageous thinking is a necessary foundation, though one that has frequently been undermined. Nor is it just human beings who are active in this undermining work. For centuries, the great Ahrimanic powers have been at work amidst humanity. One of the many things that Ahrimanic powers have worked to bring about to sow confusion amongst humanity, a state of darkness within which light must be found anew, is the obscuring of human insight that all matter is rooted in the spirit, and that all spirit seeks to manifest materially. The world has been torn asunder, and things that belong together have been separated. Above all, if we study the ongoing stream of Christian history, not Christianity itself, we find Ahrimanic powers working in humanity through these historical developments, working with great vigor. Among many other things, we should be aware of this, the sundering that has arisen between the Son and its power on the one hand, and Christ and the Christ power on the other. If the connection between these two things is not acknowledged again, it will be hard for the world to find a relationship with the Spirit. And one of the key tasks of spiritual science is to enable people to rediscover the Son mystery in a different way, corresponding to the Christ mystery as spiritualizing impulse in humanity. In eras prior to the mystery of Golgotha, this solar mystery could not yet be the Christ mystery, though it became so directly afterward. Julian the Apostate was still aware of the Sun mystery in its ancient form, but was not yet aware of it as the Christ mystery. His tragic fate was to fall prey to the delusion that he should tell humanity about the Sun's spiritual power, which led him to being murdered during his Persian campaign. But in the 19th century, another spiritual undertaking of Ahrimanic powers was to prevent humanity from knowing anything of what I have described, the Sun mystery's connection with other mysteries. We have to be fully aware of these things. Here I will mention something that would be considered delusional if I were not talking to people with some preparation, but to an academic association or such like. I am compelled to speak the truth as I see it, and we can leave aside here the question of who is actually delusional. In the 19th century, an idea took root, which nowadays dominates all of science. And as it goes on securing its dominance, we'll never allow healthy ideas about cultural and spiritual life to make any headway. The founding principles of chemistry and physics include the idea of the conservation of energy. Wherever you turn, you will hear it said that forces only transform rather than disappear. The examples usually cited are, of course, all separately justifiable. If I stroke the top of a table, I apply pressure, but rather than being consumed, this energy transforms itself into heat. All powers or forces do transform in this way. Energy and force transform. The theory of the conservation of energy is a motto that has pervaded all scientific thinking today and is now established as an axiom showing that substances, matter, and their attendant forces or energies do not arise and disappear. If we cite this theory within due confines, there is nothing to say against it. But this is not what happens. Instead, it becomes a rigid scientific dogma. In the 19th century, specifically, a strange Ahrimanic coarsening of ideas occurred. Julius Robert Meyer published a really very beautiful treatise on the conservation of energy in 1842, which most leading minds in Germany dismissed as amateurish. Julius Robert Meyer was later locked up in a mental asylum, although today we know his discovery was of groundbreaking importance. Yet it is easy to show that the very people who nowadays refer to this scientific law have not actually read what he wrote. There is a volume on the history of philosophy by Ueberweg, which mentions Meyer in passing. If you read these few lines, you can tell immediately that this historian of philosophy, who is compulsory reading for all students, has never read what Meyer wrote. For if he had, he could never have written such tripe. The fine spiritual way in which Meyer presented his work did not pass into human souls. Instead, it was greatly coarsened. And this is because Meyer's version of the idea was abandoned, while that of the English brewer Joule and the physician Helmholtz entered scientific discourse instead. But no one thinks it necessary today to consider such things, which ought by rights to figure at our centers of higher learning. People also ought to study why Darwinism spread so rapidly. Believe me, if Darwin's book on the origin of species by natural selection had simply been published like any other book, it would not have spread like wildfire through popular circles. No, the ground had been prepared for Darwin's work. In 1844, a long time before Darwin, therefore, a book had been cobbled together and been published, a trivial compendium of all the things later stated by Lamarck and others. This was a speculative publishing venture which Robert Chambers in Edinburgh embarked upon. Knowing that 19th century instincts would herald such a publication, Darwin's work tumbled headlong into an atmosphere fully ripe for such ideas. He merely interpreted what he found by applying to it Lamarck's theory of natural selection, with which English pragmatists had long been familiar. Previous to this, a book by Patrick Matthew, entitled On Naval Timber and Arboriculture, had been published and expressly stated the selection theory. It would be important, actually, to trace the ways in which these things found their way into 19th century culture. History, as it is presented, is a convenient myth, a great deception in most fields. We ought instead to study what actually happened. You see, it makes a difference whether a young person knows he is dealing with a scientific fact or merely with the thoughts of Joule, an English beer brewer. It makes a difference for him to know whether something entered 19th century scientific discourse as a result of efforts expended in real research, or whether such ideas became prevalent due to the entrepreneurial activity of an Edinburgh bookseller, Robert Chambers. Such knowledge can lead us to a right appraisal of the truth, and truth is something humanity must take as its guideline in every matter. This idea of absolute rather than relative permanence of substance and energy is what nowadays prevents people from discovering the place where substance does actually vanish into nothing, and where new substance arises. This place could be ascertained physiologically today, but the dogma of the conservation of energy prevents people from seeking or finding it. The sole place where this happens, or rather a great many of them, is the human organism. Substance does not merely pass through the human organism, but during the process that can be inwardly experienced in the synthesis of conception and death, particular substances that we have assimilated vanish from the body, forces disappear, and new ones are engendered. The processes involved here have been observed for a longer time now than people realize, though no value is accorded to such observations. We need only pay careful attention to the blood circulation inside the eye, EYE. Using instruments that are sensitive enough nowadays to observe this outwardly, it would be possible to demonstrate in purely external, physical ways what I have just described. The blood can be seen to travel to a peripheral organ, to vanish into it, and then to be engendered again in it, giving rise not to blood circulation as such, but to creation and disappearance. These things happen, but the dogmatic ideas of modern science prevent observation of them, and this means, in turn, that people fail to grasp the reality of certain processes. Modern science sees no significance at all in the merely physical death of human beings. In all other respects, scientific research is greatly concerned with death, until it fails to engage with the nature of life. But dying as such receives no notice. Otherwise, the dead are a matter of interest, as confirmed by an example I heard only yesterday. Hemmerling was buried in a provisional grave in Graz in 1889. He was to be moved to another grave later. And during this transfer, I heard this yesterday from the gentleman who discovered it, the skull disappeared. There was no sign of the skull all of a sudden. The gentleman who told me this followed it up, and it turned out that a plaster cast of the skull was made at the University Museum. Wrapped in newspaper, the skull was kept there, and only rejoined the rest of Hammerling's body when this matter was discovered. So people are interested in the dead, but not with the fact of death itself. Actually, a study of dying, of death, can lead to the most important insights. The dust originating from human bodies, as I pointed out recently, seeks to journey upward into the cosmos. Unlike any other dust, this human dust, quite irrespective of whether the corpse is cremated or decomposes in a grave, would disperse into the whole cosmos, if not encompassed by sun power, by the energy existing in the sun. The light that shimmers upon the surface of a glittering stone, or when we see plant colors, is only one of the sun's powers. The power that Julian the Apostate called the visible sun. Then we have the invisible sun too, underlying the visible sun in the same way that the soul underlies the external physical human organism. This energy, which naturally does not descend to earth with the physical ether rays, but only lives again within them, is what enlivens the dust of human bodies in a way that is distinctive and does not occur with anything else. No such enlivening happens with minerals, plants, or animals. After a person has died, a continual interplay occurs between his outer corporeal remains and the powers that stream down from the sun. The two things encounter each other. But these forces that stream down from the sun to move the dust of human corpses are also those the dead person himself discovers as soul, spiritual, and telechy after death. While we are incarnated in a physical body, we see the physical sun. Whereas after death, after passing through the gate of death, we discover the sun, first of all, as the cosmic entity which enlivens human dust below on the earth. This is one of the general discoveries we make after death. We learn to discern the interwoven nature of sun power and human dust. And by doing so, by becoming aware of this tissue woven from human dust and sun power, we learn firstly the secret of reincarnation altogether, from its other aspect, as preparation for our next incarnation, as what weaves our next incarnation out of the cosmos. And at the same time, we also learn the other aspect of certain realities upon which the mystery of reincarnation depends, which we will speak of in the next few days. This can show us the striking difference between the nature of ideas we form inwardly after our soul has passed through the gate of death and the experiences our soul has here. These after-death experiences have an entirely different soul configuration. Just as we alternate between sleeping and waking while alive, so the dead soul also alternates between different states of consciousness. I have already described this in these lectures, but would now like to do so again briefly from a different angle. One of the aspects of our life on earth is that we live inwardly in thoughts. Now the dead soul enters a reality composed of what are merely thoughts to us. In our physical life here, we perceive the external world of minerals, plants, and animals, as well as our own physical reality. But the thoughts we have are only a shadowy reality for us, whereas they are immediately vivid to the dead soul. This world into which we enter at death relates to the physical world in the same way that a solid object relates to its shadow. In our thoughts, we possess only the shadows of what the dead person experiences, which is also different in kind and quality from our experience of thought. After death, we learn something different about thoughts than we do here on earth, at least in our modern age. As far as our thoughts are concerned, we are usually wrapped in a kind of dream. But after death, we find that in thinking, that is, in living in thoughts as realities, we grow and thrive. And to the degree that we depart from thoughts and do not live in them, we grow thinner and more meager. Creation and dissolution themselves relate in the after-death condition to living in thoughts and living outside them. If people who did not try to think grew ever thinner here on earth, the world would become a very strange place. But here we experience only the inactive shadows of thoughts, which have no real effects. The dead soul, by contrast, experiences thoughts as realities. They nourish or emaciate his soul's spiritual existence. In this period during which thoughts nourish or emaciate him is also the time when he develops his life of supersensible perception. He observes thoughts streaming into him and disappearing again. This is not perception as we know it ordinarily, whose nature is clearly defined, but instead an ongoing stream of thought life that continually unites and combines with our own being. However many physical things we see here on earth, we are still constituted in the same way, and nothing much has altered in our organism. For the dead soul, this is different. What he perceives continually changes him. That is one condition, this perception of the influx and vanishing of a living stream of thought. The other condition arises when this ceases, leading to a tranquil sense of awareness in the dead soul of what has flowed through him, a clear memory, not like our ordinary abstract memory, but one which is connected with all growth and development. These two conditions alternate, and this is also really why the dead are only receptive to thoughts that are born toward them from a spiritual, scientific, or spiritual outlook. The kinds of thoughts modern people mostly have nowadays scarcely reach them, while the mode of thinking that can reach them is one modern people have little inclination for. People today like thoughts that they can in some way derive from the external world, and are not drawn to ones they have to inwardly elaborate and which therefore already have traces of the nature of thought after death, a fluidity and mobility that is felt to be far too difficult. People sit happily in laboratories with their microscopes and study cells, then write excellent books on the subject, such as Oscar Hertwig's titled The Growth of Organisms. But the moment they actually begin to think, they write nonsense, and the new book by Hertwig is an example of this. The difference is that for his second book, the corpses of thought were no longer sufficient. Strictly scientific books depend only on these thought corpses, whereas living thoughts would have been required for Hertwig's second book, and he was incapable of having these. You have to be able to really love thoughts and live in them for the second type of book. And if you really wish to create a bridge with karmically connected people who have passed through the gate of death, you need an outlook which at the very least tends toward living thinking. With this outlook, the thoughts of the living really are a special gift to the life of the dead, and make a difference, an enormous difference, to their existence between death and rebirth. But if there lives in human souls an undefined sense of everything on earth which the dead consider should be different from how it is, the living will have little joy from this thought. An undefined sense of this kind does exist. People are anxious about the view of the dead emerging in relation to much that they think and feel, do and believe in physical life. This is an unconscious anxiety, but it keeps the living caught up in materialism. The unconscious still acts even though subliminally. We need courageous thinking, not only to ensoul our conscious life of thinking, but also to fathom the profoundest depths of human nature. This is something that has to be said again and again, if the full seriousness of spiritual science is to be grasped. You see, it is not enough to grasp one or another principle, to consider something or other interesting or important in itself, but instead we need to combine all the details to form a coherent organism, as it were, from all the other contributory aspects, so that together they can be configured into a whole outlook and frame of mind. This outlook is one I have tried to characterize from the most varied perspectives. It is vital that there are some people, at least in our present era, who in this way give proper and serious attention to spiritual science, knowing that it can help cultivate living, fluid thinking in our time, and that people should not attack one another, even though they are really in agreement, that they should not, for example, bark their heads off just because someone mentions a horoscope, instead of giving the matter proper and serious consideration. An era when such a state of soul prevails engenders all kinds of other related phenomena. It would be important to really focus on the nature of the age and its often so catastrophic expressions. There are some today who are starting to think seriously, but it is also apparent how difficult people find it to get beyond an inauthentic attitude to the world and humankind which holds them captive. One question I have touched on in passing today, and which we will consider more thoroughly in the coming lectures, is this: how is it possible that Christianity, active for centuries, for millennia now, has nevertheless allowed our current conditions to emerge? The answer to this would require insights which humanity in general does not yet include in its scientific and religious discourses. Only spiritual science can offer them. It is, after all, a very serious question. What should be our attitude to Christianity today, given that this same Christianity has been at work for centuries and yet has allowed our current circumstances to arise? Most curious of all, however, are the people who propose a return to forms of Christianity that existed before contemporary developments began, and who therefore have no real feeling that returning to the same original conditions will inevitably allow the same consequences to emerge from them again. Such people will, no doubt, find it very hard to see that something thoroughly new, of a quite different order, has to enter culture. I will speak further of this next time. The end of Lecture 12.